You're listening to Classic Dialogues, Land Power in the Indo-Pacific, a China Land Power Study Center production. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guests and are not necessarily those of the Department of the Army, the U.S. Army War College, or any other agency of the U.S. government. I'm Josh Arostegui, the China Land Power Study Center Chair, and I'm joined by Rick Gunnell, the Research Professor of China Military Studies here, and Dennis Blasco, retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel. Blasco is a former military intelligence officer and foreign area officer specializing in China. He's an independent analyst and author of The Chinese Army Today. I'm pretty excited about this one because, you know, the last several podcasts I've been involved in have included discussions with authors of articles that we've posted or senior leadership within the Army. But today I get to Rick and I get to speak with one of our mentors, and we both consider ourselves proteges of Mr. Blasco, who for the longest time was really the one or the premier voice in talking about the Chinese land domain. He literally wrote the book on the Chinese Army and has written countless articles on, you know, the PLA, you know, Air Force Airborne Corps, the PLA Navy Marine Corps, People's Armed Police, militia, the list goes on and on. He's a legend in our field, and we're really excited to have you join us today, Dennis.
Well, thank you, and I'm looking to you guys to pick up the slack.
Rick, I'll go first, if that's okay.
Please.
I really want the listeners to get a quick snapshot from from Mr. Blasco, which I'm sure it's not a quick one because the history of Dennis's contributions to this community it's long and it's expansive. But Dennis, how did you find yourself in this field, writing about, you know, the Chinese Army and ground forces?
Well, obviously, it wasn't part of a plan, but I did start to study Chinese as a freshman, a plebe at West Point in 1970. I started the study of Chinese because upperclassmen told me Chinese sounds like music, and I said, "Well, I like music," and that the professors and upperclassmen don't haze you in the way that the French department did at the time. So I said, well, I don't need any more hazing. And so that started me on the Chinese language path, but it also got me to Taiwan in the summer of 1992 for a two-week visit with my mentor and a guy that I still really appreciate, Colonel Monty Bullard. Well, Colonel Bullard at the time of my graduation said, well, I'd recommend military intelligence as a branch, because in 1974, we had just finished our ground operations in Vietnam. But he said, going military intelligence, you'll always have a real world job. So I selected military intelligence with a 1-year detail in the infantry, which I served in Germany. Then at that period of time, I focused on the Soviet forces, perhaps because, well, they were the main threat at the time, and the entire army was focused on the Soviets. So as an MI officer, I started looking at them. And the first 10 years of my career was focused primarily on the Soviets and special operations. But then came time for me to select a secondary or alternate MOS, and I said, well, I'd like to be a foreign area officer, and following in the footsteps of Colonel Monty Bullard, I'd like to be a China foreign area officer. So I ended up at the Naval Postgraduate School and then went to DLI 83-84, and then spent a year and a half in Hong Kong studying at the British Ministry of Defense Chinese Language Institute, where I had the opportunity in 1985 and 86 to travel around China. And during that time, especially as an S2 at a battalion in Italy, I learned about what DIA was doing in open sources and publishing books and handbooks on the Soviet forces. I remember the Soviet Motorized Rifle Company, Soviet Motorized Rifle Battalion, Soviet Motorized Rifle Regiment and Division, reading those things and using them as guides for helping my training of the troops, especially the recon troops that might be initially observing. And so from the very beginning, I started thinking about open source, the use of open sources, especially as it applies to training the troops. At the same time, I also was trained as an imagery analyst and spent a little over 2 years in DIA looking at the group of Soviet forces in East Germany that had a lot of tanks, a lot of new equipment at the time, and looking at them. And that was all before choosing to become a FAO. So that's what got me interested in both China and open sources. And after undergoing my FAO training, I ended up in DIA for 3 years. Then I spent looking at China, but all of East Asia, forces in East Asia. Then I spent time in the 2nd Infantry Division as a brigade S2 during the first Gulf War, and from there went to Beijing for 3 years, from 92 to 95. What I like to say was the pinnacle of my otherwise mediocre military career was in Beijing, and ended my attaché years with one year in Hong Kong from 95 to 96. I retired in 97, and pretty much since 1997 on, have been focused exclusively on open source analysis of the Chinese military. Fortunately, the internet came about, so I was able to do a lot of that in real time. And then Google Earth came about, so I was able to do a little bit of imagery analysis also off of the internet. And so now for actually longer than I was in the Army, I've been doing open source analysis and continued basically to start every day with going through the what I can see in the Chinese newspapers, the Chinese military newspapers and television stations. So it's just a matter of I figured I couldn't do anything else. So I might as well try to keep up with what I really enjoyed during my time in the Army, which was analysis and observation analysis of the PLA.
Thanks, Dennis. As a follow-up on that, how would you characterize and describe the Chinese language information environment? Do you feel that there's a lot of information? Do you feel like it's reliable? How would you describe your experience with the China IE, and kind of how has it changed over time?
Yeah, well, it certainly has changed. And I like to think that most of the official sources that I look at, even though they're communist sources, are pretty reliable, because what they are doing is talking to themselves about the situations within their own military. If I want to find propaganda, I can find propaganda, but I try to focus on what they are talking to themselves about the status of their forces and how they are basically trying to explain to each other how one unit is successful compared to another, identifying the problems in all of the units that are going on, but they're trying to teach each other through their media as to how to become a professional force. Now, what I've seen over the years is, unfortunately, the Chinese have been reading our analysis, not only mine, but many other folks, and I think they have been keyed to some of the things that we're looking for. And so within the past few years, well, within the past 2 years, I've seen the Chinese cut back on the level of detail that they include in their official news articles. And this comes at the same time that the United States government made the decision to restrict the open source reporting only to limited amounts of people in the government. So it's become, in the past couple years, very much more difficult to access useful information about the PLA than it had been, say, 10, 15 years ago. There, part of the problem always has been there is mountains of words, tens of thousands of words, but sometimes you're only looking for a couple dozen of those words. Keys that you can use to unlock some of the tasty nuggets within the mountains of fluff that is written. But in the past few years, the number of tasty nuggets have been reduced from the Chinese perspective, from their own, for purposes of their own operational security. So it's been, it's much, much more difficult now, using the sources that I'm familiar with, to figure out what's going on a real-time basis. Oftentimes you can figure out what happened 2 or 3 years ago, but it's harder to keep up with the daily events as they go on through the open sources. For the younger analysts out there, there are social media platforms that provide hints and provide clues, but then you need to keep on digging to verify all that stuff. I don't do that as much as some of the younger guys do. Younger guys, men and women, do, but that may be a path in the future that I'll let others explore. But the environment has changed, not only, like I say, through the media, which has become more restricted, but obviously now we just don't have as much contact officially with the PLA as we did during my time 30 years ago in Beijing. And at that time, they were willing to talk to us, I think, a lot more than they're willing to talk now. So it's a much different environment, much more difficult environment. And that's even before we get into the entire security elements of trying to live and work in Beijing.
Well, speaking of changing environments, you know, in the years following your attaché time and retirement, I think it can be frankly said that it's probably the formative years of the PLA in modernization of both, platforms, organization, warfighting concepts, operational theory, etc. So, I remember reading your book in 2013 and my mind was blown, about how much I didn't actually know about the PLA and the Chinese military, organization at large. But in that time frame, only a few years later, drastic changes occurred that somewhat negated much of what was in the book, but also negated everything that we all knew about the PLA prior to that. Now, in that time that you've been writing all this stuff, following your retirement and, your time as an independent analyst and working for different think tanks, so much has changed. And I'm curious, this is probably a difficult one to answer, but what are some key things that listeners should know that, hey, look, back in the day, it used to be like this, but now it's a completely different environment. And these are some things that you should be aware of from, the PLA Army or any other aspect of the PLA. That's a tough one, but I think it'd be, I love your perspectives on these types of topics.
Well, to me, the most important thing is that the entire time that I've been looking at the PLA from a personal standpoint, and literally PLA modernization, military modernization, started after the first, or after the 1979 Vietnam War. And I was there during the first few phases of military modernization, when that was just involved primarily reorganization and huge cuts to manpower throughout the forces. It wasn't until the late 90s, after I left, that the PLA's budget really started to grow. The defense industries really started to produce modern equipment, especially the electronics industry in the late 90s. It took off. But also at exactly that time, the late 90s, the PLA basically said, okay, now we're going to start on a 50-year modernization. They didn't. The 20 years before, the 80s and 90s, were all a prequel to the long-term modernization that started in, for them, in about 1997, for a lot of reasons, which we won't get into here. But in the late 90s, they laid out a 50-year plan to modernize. And so that's why what we're seeing is constantly changing. The goals of modernization in that time, what they seek to accomplish, have changed over the 25 years since they made this decision. The goals have changed, but the timeline hasn't. The timeline initially was established in the late 90s as with milestones at 2010, 2020, and then 2049, i.e. the 100th anniversary of the creation of the PRC. That timeline, the milestones have changed, having passed 2010 and 2020 now. They've added the 2027 milestone, 2035 milestone, but still the ultimate goal is 2049. I chuckle every time I read somebody who says the Chinese are engaged in a rapid military modernization. Well, rapid maybe if you consider 50 years rapid. And then if you consider 70 years rapid, when it actually started in 1979. So yes, they're doing a lot of things that they have never done before, and things are happening appear to be happening very quickly, especially in the equipment, on the equipment side of the equation. But what the Chinese themselves understand, especially the Chinese leadership from Xi Jinping on down, is that the much more difficult part of the equation is the personnel, the training, the education, and the interaction among staffs and organization as is necessary to actually employ all this new equipment in modern operations, modern advanced, multi-domain, advanced combined arms and joint operations. They realize that the hardest thing is training their people, getting changing the structure of their personnel force to fit with the needs of all this new equipment. And this is why, from my perspective, the most important thing to them, the thing that they want more than anything else, is time to continue on this modernization. They can be external factors can motivate them to shift time frames and shift goals. But if they were given their choice, they would prefer to stick to the program, the 50-year program that they have. I'm not going to try to predict what's going to happen after 2049, but I think they would really prefer to continue down the next 25 years, which is what it is, on the path of modernization at the speed that they have been thinking about for these last multiple decades. And in doing so, one of the things, you mentioned it, Josh, one of the things that is most frustrating from my perspective is that they're in a constant change of reform. They're in a constant mode of reform and change. Things, because of what I focus on, just about everything that I have written within days or weeks, certainly months of it being published, there have been changes that makes some of the stuff that I've written OBE overcome by events as soon as it's published. And so that, you mentioned the 2012 book. Yeah, it was accurate for about 6 months. But they continued to change organizations. And then in 2016, 2017, they reformed the entire structure differently than they had and more extensively than in the previous 50 years. So it's, from an open source perspective, you're constantly chasing their tail. So that's what I'd focus on, the long-term plan that they've got.
So anyone who's spent time in China has at least a story or 100. Do you have any anecdotes from your time in China that you found particularly interesting?
Actually, yes, quite a few. And some of them occurred with Mark Stokes, who was my compatriot at the time, as an attaché. But it was a different situation then. And we could ride our bicycles or drive around. And we could literally give rides to PLA or PAP personnel at times. And some of our experiences involve rides in cars and rides on, on bicycles throughout China.
Hey, Dennis, we're going to go ahead and wrap it up here. But, Rick, do you have anything you want to close with here?
Nope. Just thanks, Dennis, for all the service to the community you've provided. You've mentored many, many people and made us all a lot smarter. So thank you.
Well, thank you guys.
And I second Rick's, comments. We're both better analysts and researchers because of the work that you have done in the past and the mentorship you provided. So again, we're real honored to have you join us today.
Well, thank you. And, I'm very encouraged to see the center being formed and folks like you coming to the center. And so I'm looking for great things in the future from the center.
No pressure.
No pressure.
All right. Well, again, appreciate your time, Dennis. For more Army War College podcasts, check out Decisive Point, Conversations on Strategy, and SSI Live.